Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The calendar has changed, but the trends we observed last year continue with us into the new year. Change is in the air, and the powers that be in politics and media are resisting. The status quo is being tested. This is what could make 2024 a watershed year. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He is an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, so we start out with George in Budapest. You know, at the end of last year, going into the new year, there's this sense of foreboding out there. A lot of commentators, someone that you and I very much admire and respect, Tucker Carlson, has been saying this, and a number of other people, that they're looking at 2024 as certainly a year of change. That's an understatement, okay? But we have also the bull in the China shop, the U.S. presidential election, and the bull, his name is Donald Trump. And in my lifetime, I have never seen such a political comeback. I mean, this is almost like Nixon in 68. Trump left office with deplorable public opinion approval. Now he's doing really quite well, George.
Well, you're absolutely right to use the word foreboding, because we really are in uncharted waters. I mean, we have a presidential candidate who will almost certainly win the nomination of his party. He's got four criminal cases pending against him. Some of them the trials may well take place before the election. There is an absolute determination to stop him. Biden, the president who actually runs the Justice Department, has made it clear that he intends to stop him, and not by any means possible. And this is really very dangerous, because Trump has his followers, very, very loyal followers, and they will not just sit still for the hobbling of a president by the use of lawfare, by the use of the Justice Department, by going after him with criminal charges that have never been brought against a former president. And then you have to wonder, well, what happens when all of these methods of destroying Trump fail? I mean, not just the criminal cases, but, for instance, trying to take him off the ballot. Again, it's never been done. But, one state after another trying to take him off the ballot, that you really have a very, very explosive mix. Who knows how that's going to play out?
Who knows how that's going to play out? You know, Martin, it's an interesting thing about American politics. America is actually very decentralized, because we have a federal republic of states. But there are two things Americans do in unison. You should pay taxes, okay? And the only office the entire country collectively elects is the president and vice president as a ticket. And this is the only collective thing left politically in the United States. And as George has just said here, taking a major candidate off the ballot, well, with no good, understandable, reasonable reason, is you're courting not just chaos, but worse than chaos. Martin.
Yeah. Why are you afraid to say it? Civil war. That's what we're talking about. We shouldn't forget America's a young country as well. It's a great country, but it's a young country. And I think, there are so many what ifs when we look at this situation with Trump and the judiciary system. There's a lot of new ground to be broken. I agree, it is very worrying that if he actually gets nailed and he faces these prosecutions and faces jail time, that there's no good scenario there. There's no solution, so-called solution, for the country or for Biden or anybody, but there's an interesting thing that keeps coming through there. What I've noticed, though, is that every time Trump gets one of these cases against him, his popularity soars. And so you've got this conundrum. And I'm sure even sleepy Joe Biden, who just last week did his thing again of finishing a speech, turning around, facing a blank screen, and just sort of looking at the blank screen, wondering when someone would jump through it and shake his hand, or I don't know, give him an ice cream or something. He's getting worse. The senility is really settling in, you know. One wonders whether he's worked this out, whether the Biden people have actually sort of said, actually, we're in a catch-22 situation now. We're in a hole and we're digging, and so the outcome is only going to be bad. But none of us have got the crystal ball. None of us can say what's actually going to happen. I think it'll be really fascinating to see how this plays out. But again, is it just me as a foreigner looking out, looking in? It seems to me that there's a lot of corruption in the judiciary system. One politics have just taken it over, and I think that might be a basis of the country turning a new leaf. Will the next generation of voters now ask for the politics to be taken completely out of the appeals process?
Well, George, I mean, the interesting fact as we go into this year and we look at American politics is that if you look at over the last like 30, 40 years where, wages have stagnated, good paying blue collar jobs have virtually disappeared. You have a younger generations, plural, that don't feel like they have any stake in the game anymore. A lot of young people believe that they'll never be able to own their own home. We have an ideology of live with less and you'll be happy. Well, it's all rich people say that, okay? That's a kind of a long introduction to is the democracy deficit. I mean, the last thing you have is the vote, but if you're not allowed to exercise your vote, then what's this whole thing worth? What's the whole system worth to me?
That's exactly right. And this essentially decline in the standard of life. I mean, remember, America was always held up to be the paradigm of a wealthy, successful country. I mean, people in Europe were growing up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, thinking, well, hey, look, America, that's where people are making money. That's where there's a dynamic economy. That isn't there anymore. And essentially, it is like a stagnating empire where you have a fat ruling elite that is doing very well, making a lot of money.
And COVID didn't help. It didn't hurt them. It didn't hurt
it
their
didn't
bottom
hurt.
line.
And then it pursues an agenda such as the green agenda that suits it just fine, but is obviously hurting most Americans who, in one way or another, depend on a manufacturing industry that requires a lot of energy that isn't provided by the alternative recyclable fuels that this elite is espousing. And I think that explains the rise of Donald Trump. I mean, that Trump is somehow is promising, well, we'll go back to the era when, we were doing well, when we were held up to
Well,
be
it's
the
interesting,
paradigm of this a successful country.
and it's very interesting, George, is that when we have these populist figures around the world, Viktor Orban has been dumped on a lot, but we have this a new leadership in Slovakia, and they're always called their version of Trump, which is a metaphor for dissatisfaction with the status quo. I want to change gears because there's so much we need to talk about in so little time. Martin, NATO has a big birthday coming up this year. Big birthday. When people get to that age, they usually retire, but NATO decides to keep going here. What's going to happen? I mean, this is a make or break one for them. They dithered last year with Ukraine. And as we speak right now, there's nothing to cheer about, write home about when it comes to Ukraine. So NATO's really got itself in a jam. Of course, it put itself there. It's self-inflicted, Martin.
Yeah, I've said before that I think that there's two scenarios really for the NATO birthday. Either NATO finds a solution in Ukraine, it won't be a great solution, but a solution, some sort of solution where it can present itself to the international community and basically BS its way through whatever they've done. They'll claim that they've got some sort of victory if they can stop the fighting, if they can claim the credit. claim the credit for stopping the fighting. That will be what they will present. Or they will hit us with fake news. They'll actually fake the entire thing. And I'm sure the media people now are actually working out how we can spin this, you know, who we can wheel in, you know, what journalists can we get on board. They must be planning it now. And I'm absolutely certain there's going to be a lot of fake news leading up to June about NATO and what it's done and what it's achieved, you know, and Biden's going to be there doing the silly handshakes. And probably, I think Ukraine may well be just completely airbrushed out of the whole thing, because you've got to remember that no matter how much we follow Ukraine and, you know, how geopolitical nerds, you know, absorb themselves in the subject, most Americans don't really know anything about Ukraine. Most Americans don't know where it is on the map, you know, so they might be thinking, actually, if we just stopped reporting on Ukraine.
Well, George, you're a better expert on this. It was at the New York Times or the Washington Post that took that subject off their menu bar. They just, I think it was the last week of the year, the tab that you have that you can hit Ukraine news. They dropped it, okay? What are they preparing us for, George?
Well, I do tend to think, and I've said this before, that they will push for Ukraine membership in NATO. What's, you know, left of Ukraine? They're not going to be able to incorporate those parts of Ukraine that are now lost, the four oblasts that will be incorporated in the Russian Federation. But then they will say, well, this part is now in NATO, and they'll say that, hey, well, we achieved something. And the thing is that, you know, NATO, for them, this is the goose that lays the golden egg. It gives a rationale for NATO. Well, you know, we need to keep going because of the Russian threat. You know, this is an existential threat for us. And they're peddling the story now, you know, throughout NATO land that Russia poses a threat to us. You know, any moment, you know, they can attack Denmark, they can attack Germany. We need NATO now more than ever. And for the United States, they still are determined on inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia.
Well, can we fuse your argument and Martin's argument together? Is that, okay, Russia is obviously a threat to NATO land, but they can airbrush Ukraine out of it, okay? Because we know what the Russians are up to. Is there an amalgam there, George?
Well, I don't think it's because then if they just simply abandon Ukraine, then they would have to worry that the entirety of Ukraine will be taken over by Russia. That would be a huge strategic defeat.
Russia wants to do that, but there's no
evidence. At least they'll be under geopolitical influence of Russia, that they'll come up with some leadership, a kind of NATO would call a quisling leadership in Kiev. Some Medvedchuk or Arestovich-like figure will be basically doing the bidding of Moscow. That's how they would spin this, or at least that's how they would see it. And therefore, this would be a strategic defeat for NATO. I don't think
that's the operative word, strategic defeat. But for whom? Gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion about the new year. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the Home Edition. To remind you, we're discussing the year 2024. All right, let's go back to Martin in Marrakesh. Unfortunately, the conflict in Gaza continues. And how is this going to change your region of the world where you live? Because, you know, we've often heard the narrative that, you know, Arab elites, they've never really been particularly interested in the fate of the Palestinian people, but their people do. I mean, democracy isn't the political system that comes to mind when you think of the greater Middle East, okay? So the Arab street, if I can use that term, I know a lot of people don't like it, but there is a very strong feeling about what's going on in Gaza and how it relates to how they see the outside world, particularly the West.
Well, in my view, it's going to turn the clock back to pre-1991, where we had the Cold War. I think there's going to be an intensified level of division. It's a very divisive subject, you know. Yes, Arab countries, particularly some elites who have really sold themselves on the whole Palestinian story, like Erdogan in Turkey, or MBS in Saudi Arabia. They're there, and being a Palestine is a really big part of their political identity. Those leaders are going to have a hard time battling with the realities of what's going on. But I think we might see an emergence, a darker, perhaps not such a. What I'm trying to say is that something which we a secretive sort of emergence, a nefarious coalition of some of these Arab countries that may well fund terrorist activities with Hamas in the future. So that may well come from Iran, Qatar, or Turkey. But, you know, looking at the rest of the Arab world, what you see is now division. You know, you've got some countries that are really making a stand against what's going on, like Algeria, for example. And then you've got other countries like Morocco here and Emirates who are nailed to the bedposts of the whole Israeli deal. Unfortunately, they're in too deep. You know, they've invested too much business-wise, you know, and so forth. So a lot of division we can expect. And I think the breaking point of the surreptitious plan, I think, which is underway, you know, which might take months to get off the ground, but I think that's happening against Israel. But, you know, looking on the region, you know, you could probably put a bet on Joe Biden messing things up and just escalating the situation even further, because just in the space of the last week or so, we're talking about American frigates and aircraft carriers taking pot shots at Houthis in the Red Sea, you know, and then we're even talking about hitting. Or it's happened, actually. You know, the White House and the Pentagon have reported on a number of U.S. airstrikes on Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. So we're almost there. You know, we've been talking for a lot.
What we've seen, George, over, you know, ever since the global war on terror, outside of Israel, who does the United States count on in the Middle East now? I mean, I'm not sure the list is very long. Okay. I mean, Iraq told them to leave. They won't leave. The United States illegally occupies part of Syria. The Saudis, they're pretty moody. They can go. They have a lot of leverage right now. Okay, and they've shown very little respect for the Biden administration. Very little.
That's exactly right. But the sad part of this is that in the United States, there has been no change at all. I mean, if you look at Congress, it's still 90%, maybe 95%, absolutely unequivocally behind Israel. I mean, Israel can do anything. I mean, Israel could just simply, you know, tomorrow just release a nuclear weapon, and you still get the 95% will say, we must stand with Israel, you know, that Israel is fighting for its existence. And nothing could ever can change that. It's so appalling. And, you know, if one looks at the Middle East, I mean, there obviously, you know, as Martin describes, these divisions. But the fact is that, you know, with many of these Arab countries, you know, they haven't even broken diplomatic relations with Israel. Mm. I mean, they're continuing the same way. I mean, they haven't said, oh, we now renounce the Abraham Accords. That's it. You know, this is, you know, we made a huge mistake. This is a horrific, terrible state that we've established diplomatic relations. That hasn't ended. So, yeah, they make these condemnations. They go to the United Nations, make all the right noises. But in practical terms, they haven't really done anything. I mean, it's essentially Hamas and the Houthis. I mean, they're the only ones who are actually doing something.
Martin, address that issue, because then you really have this division between elites that have their very specific interests, and then everybody else. And for everybody else, this issue of Palestine is paramount.
Yeah, I think George mentioned practical level. The practical level, I think, is not going to come from the political elites. I think the practical level is going to come from people, individuals. You know, who would want to be an Israeli businessman now traveling around the Middle East? You know, I mean, there is a hell of a kickback. There's a lot of anti-Semitism now, which is frothing at the surface. And where I am in Morocco, you know, you have entire political parties now representing hundreds of thousands of people who are calling now for Israelis who have joint passports in Morocco to now actually lose their citizenship, their Moroccan citizenship. So it's boiling up in some places, and there's a contradiction a lot of the time. You know, officially here in Morocco, we're with Israelis, you know, but you have a huge amount of number of people who are really unhappy about that. And so I think on a practical level, you're going to see a lot of resistance. Just look at the internet. Just go to Facebook and see the informal level of boycotting Israel is going through now. It's not just Hutus taking pot shots at their ships. It's, you know, countries and people all around the world are boycotting their products and really campaigning quite vociferously, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of awareness now out there on Facebook of what Israeli products are, and not just Israeli products, but companies that support Israel as well. You know, there's a distinction there. So the practical level is the political elites will have to recognize this at some point. When they head towards the elections, they have to recognize the millions of people, you know, who don't sign up to that, what George called the 95% of Congress backing Israel, you know. So there will be a turning point at some point. And 2024 is incredibly interesting, not just because you've got Biden heading to the polls. If he does, if he actually makes it, I'm still not sure, you know, with his senility, the way it is. I mean, how many times can he mess up, you know, before the Democrats suddenly panic at the last moment? But don't forget, you've got European elections in June as well. And this is much, much bigger, in my view, because, you know, George mentioned earlier about the fatigue, you know, setting in across America and how the system seems to be slowing down. And there's a lack of confidence now in the political elites, you know. But in Europe, that transcends into people voting for far right groups as a protest vote. And so you mentioned earlier about far right leaders, populist leaders now. You know, we've got another one in the Netherlands, which is just won an unprecedented number of seats. My political friends in Belgium are telling me this is going to have an impact on the Vlaams Bloc in Belgium as well. And so, you know, watch the elections in June in the European Parliament, because that is going to be a deal breaker for
It's really interesting, George. You're in Budapest here. It's interesting watching the political landscape changing in Europe. In the Netherlands, we have the Alternative for Germany party under pressure by the government. We had change in government in Slovakia. We had an attempted colored revolution in Serbia. But there's one political figure that stands in the same place watching the landscape change, and that's Viktor Orban.
Yes, that's right. Viktor Orban, he blazed the trail, and others follow. But the curious thing is about these dubbed the far right populists is that while on Russia and Ukraine, they say, no, absolutely, this has nothing to do with us, this is really stupid for Europe. When it comes to Israel, they are very strangely pro-Israel. You know, Orban banned any pro-Palestinian demonstrations.
Voted with the United States and the United Nations.
Exactly, at the General Assembly. Wilders, also very pro-Israeli. And of course, if the Reform Party, this is Nigel Farage's party, stands in the UK elections, Farage is also very pro-Israel. So there's a kind of a slight disjunction there. We have the right, which again, hey, Russia, that's nothing to do with us. That's stupid to fight with them. But they're very much in the tank for Israel. So, you know, it's hard to know how all these things are going to shake up. And then again, in the United States, yes, I mean, no question, Biden has lost a lot of support within his own party, who are very unhappy about his stance on Gaza. But you can all those people, you tell them, if you don't vote for Biden, Trump, the terrible Trump, is going to come back.
George, to add the irony to it, Trump is very pro-Israel.
Exactly.
Well.
Get another one. Yeah. That's right.
You know, Martin, that's one of the things that I find really disheartening is that conservatives who used to be the biggest defenders of free speech are now some of the biggest oppressors of free speech. And it all revolves around this issue of Israel, what is anti-Semitism. I think most people have no idea what Zionism really means. No. And how it just kind of short circuits the discourse. George has just mentioned it.
It just shuts down debate, doesn't it? You know, as soon as you throw that into the argument, you know, the other person is supposed to stop talking, and we don't really understand anything beyond then. You know, I've seen this in the UK a lot with debate about racism, and I've been part of that and a victim of it. But it's true. I don't think it's a conservative thing or a left-wing or a right-wing thing. I think it's elites generally, in my experience as a journalist,
Good point. Good point.
they tend to harp on about freedom of speech until it bites them on the ass, you know. And then there's a problem, and then lawyers get wheeled out and get paid, you know, colossal amounts of money to fix the problem. You know, free speech. Looking back, you know, last year and now looking ahead to 2024, I wonder how much freedom of expression will play a role in this huge political movement, these changes that we're witnessing, you know, whether people completely abandon mainstream media and just go 100%.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end on this note. But, George, you know, I hope that, you know, in future generations, they won't turn back and say, you know, like us on Crosstalk here, those were the days when they had freedom of speech. It must have been great. 5 seconds, George, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that it may well be that if we resume in 12 months' time, we say, well, now it's really dangerous. You know, we're not able to get any kind of free speech anymore. So, yeah, this is undoubtedly the case. I think it's going to get worse. I think as
tensions
get worse.
Unfortunately, gentlemen, we have to end on that depressing note. I want to thank my guests in Marrakesh and in Budapest. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.